The language of our times. How have you changed what you say? Oh, how the English language has changed in the past year. There are new words and phrases. Think social distancing and Zoom pants. And newly overused ones like pivot and unprecedented. Many of these new ways of speaking derive from the coronavirus pandemic, others from the social justice movement, and some reflect evolving corporate speak or teen slang. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the language of our times, from using gender-neutral pronouns to calling people a Karen. Which words will stay with us and which will melt as quickly as a snowflake? We're finna talk about language next on Maine Calling. But first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The way we speak today is already different from 1 year ago. Words like pandemic and asymptomatic were not part of our daily conversations back then. Today, we will talk about how rapid changes in our world shape our language and about the words and phrases that have become prevalent. Some of them are useful, some annoying, and some have already morphed into another meaning than before. Joining me to discuss the language of our times, Daniel Sanford, who is a linguist at Bates College. He serves as director of writing at Bates and the Academic Resources Commons. He's an author. He's written the Roman and Littlefield Guide for Peer Tutors, and he's also a lecturer in the humanities. Dan Sanford, thank you for coming on, and I'm so looking forward to this conversation.
It's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
We invite your comments and questions. What new words or phrases have you noticed that you're using a lot these days or noticing that other people are using? Maybe they're words that you like or maybe you find them annoying. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post our comment to our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, that phone number is different from the number for the pledge drive. Our phone number on Maine Calling, 1-800-399-3566. Dan, this is a topic I could talk about all day, but let's start with words that are new because of the pandemic. What words are you seeing emerging that either are new to our language or really weren't used nearly as often as they are today?
There has been so much change in language in the last year due to the pandemic. And I think this will be a theme throughout our discussion. You know, when you have a new concept that a culture is grappling with and needs to communicate about, in language we have three options for dealing with that. You know, you can borrow a term from another language, you can coin a new term, or you can repurpose existing language. And the pandemic was so fast that I think what we've seen is we've done a lot of repurposing existing words and existing language from English to describe it. So I think the two that we've all been really clobbered with in the last year have been social distancing and flattening the curve, which those are all comprised of words that we've had around in language, but they're being combined and used in totally new ways. And they're so interesting because of how fast they spread. Social distancing especially. I can't think of a better example of a phrase that so quickly became so widespread.
And what's so interesting, something like social distancing or flatten the curve, or I'm going to add to that asymptomatic, these are things that might have been used when you take a college course on something, on econ or public health, but not everyday language.
Right. And so social distancing labels something fairly complex. Same with flattening the curve. I mean, that involves, parabolic functions and probability distributions. It gives us a shorthand for understanding something that has a lot of nuance, and that's really how language works. We have these abstract concepts, and if we need to communicate them, you know, we'll get a word from it from somewhere. And in this case, I mean, these are like flattening the curve is from medicine and public health and now incredibly widespread in the public lexicon. And that's what language does. When we talk about language, we tend to focus about how productive it is, how we can combine words to get at any meaning we want to talk about. But what's equally important and striking is how language conventionalizes. You know, we tend to say the same things over and over again, and meanings develop and grow out of that process. So both of these phrases, social distancing, flattening the curve, asymptomatic, they've all sort of brought on new conventionalized meanings in the last year.
And I'm going to talk about another word that we may add to the list, pivot.
Yeah. Pivot is a great example of what metaphor does for us in language. So when people think of metaphor, they tend to think of really florid language, like what light through yonder window breaks. But the vast majority of metaphor that we use in language isn't like that. Metaphor does a lot of heavy lifting in our language. It allows us to talk and think about these very nebulous, abstract ideas. So during the last year, we've all had to do a lot individually and as a culture of changing how we do things and how we think about things. And metaphor really helped us to do this. So the idea of a pivot, literally, right, is you have this central thing and then something's rotating around it. So humans aren't great at understanding abstract concepts, but it's really, really good for us. We're good at thinking about really concrete things, like a simple machine, like a pivot. So through this metaphor, we're able to apply this idea of really rapidly changing direction and use it to think about and talk about this much more complicated, mushy thing, which is changing behaviors and ideas. So using that as a metaphor gives us this language to talk about something very abstract. And that's a thing we've done a lot in language, like the way that historically the word see, you know, has expanded from its literal meaning of seeing something with your eyes to understanding something. And that's a really common way for words to grow and change in language. And I think that's
sure, saying something like, I see what you mean.
Exactly. And that's part of this really widespread metaphor in the language where we talk about understanding in the language of sight. And it gives us a way to talk about something that would otherwise be hard to talk about.
I love this. I think about this a lot because I'm one of those people who will have pet peeves about a new way that a word is being used. I remember a couple decades ago when people were beginning to use the word branding. It really bothered me for some reason. But I realized that I sort of need to just get over this because that's how language changes. After all, we are not all speaking old English.
That's what's so funny about language. Language is this natural phenomenon. It's like patterns in the clouds or, you know, the pattern you get in a dirt road, that washboard pattern, or a termite mound. And as humans, we're participating in building this thing, which is just this kind of complex structure that grows out of natural processes. But it's also something that we have really strong feelings about. You know, we all are walking around with these really strong attitudes and ideas about language. And our ideas about how language changes is a huge part of that. We all have this sort of idea that language change is bad. People tend to feel like the way that the language was spoken a generation or two ago is the right way to speak, and everything that happens after that is a devolution. But it's just what happens. Language is like a lava lamp. It's just constantly turning and changing.
Well, let's talk about one of those, and this is the gender-neutral pronouns, something I have to confess I struggle with because I've been such a stickler for grammar all my life, especially when I wrote, right, using the word they or them to refer to a singular person, which is today accurate and actually something that is preferred in many cases. Can you talk about that evolution?
Yeah, I'd love to. I love the story of they and them. So we're talking about singular third-person pronouns for a person of any gender. So we're talking about something like, if he or she wants it, give it to them, or they want it. This has such a long history in English. So Old English had a gender indeterminate third-person pronoun, but we lost it. English went through a lot of changes, and shifted towards inanimate objects, and our word, it. So English was sort of left with this hole of no great way to refer to a third
Wait,
person.
Let me stop you right there. In Old yeah. English, a word that was similar to it was used about people?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay.
So it
okay.
didn't refer to just inanimate objects like it. You could use it to refer to a person or an animal.
Okay, sorry, so, keep going.
Yeah, so English sort of gets left with this hole with no great way to refer to a third person, he or she, if you don't know their gender or if you didn't care to specify their gender. And we have all kinds of ways of getting around this. Like in writing, we'll do a lot of saying he or she. In the 1970s, there was a big movement to get Z going as a third-person pronoun that basically means he or she. And that's a good idea, but that sort of language engineering just doesn't usually work because languages are living things. They don't do what we want them to do. They do what they will. But meantime, there's been this very natural, organic process over decades where the plural third-person pronoun, they, which can be gender indeterminate, has gotten pulled into service. So over the years, you see it starting to get pulled in sentences like, if he or she calls, answer them, and then later coming up in sentences like, they called, where you're just not, you know, you're leaving gender out of it. But it was, and still is by many, considered wrong. But I think what's so interesting about this case is that language changes is taking care of this problem for us, that English doesn't have a great way to speak about a gender indeterminate third person. And all we need is to get out of the way. So, you know, really, this is just all about how language change is inevitable. And efforts to, you know, police language away from changing are always doomed to failure. And in this case, they're really just keeping us from being able to use this really, really handy word, especially in more formal settings and in writing.
Mm. We've talked about the pandemic changing language. What about the racial justice movement? All of a sudden, there are new words because of that. One I'm thinking about is the word anti-racist.
Yeah. So anti-racism, it's not necessarily a new word. It's been growing steadily in popularity for decades, but it's more popular than ever now. It has exploded in the last year. And I think that's because it describes the current moment in race relations so well. The idea that turning a blind eye to race, this sort of let's treat everyone the same kind of 1980s, 1990s version of diversity is not enough, that we need to acknowledge race, face what it is, and work actively against racism. There's an issue with some of our language around social justice. Equity and diversity and inclusion are all words that have unique meanings that I think we need to pay attention to. But in popular discourse, they tend to come to exist in something of a mush, used interchangeably. Anti-racism is a term with a very specific meaning, working to dismantle racist structures. But I think we can already see ways that as it comes into popular usage, it's starting to be generalized and used in a less specific way, sort of thrown into that mush with other terms. And it has a meaning that I think is important and worth holding on to.
And do you think that the surge in the use of the phrase anti-racist is because of Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think Ibram Kendi added so much to the popular usage of the term and really filling it out in pretty powerful ways and changing how we talk about it.
Also, a byproduct of the racial justice movement, calling someone a Karen. This started as a lighthearted term that young people used to label a certain middle-aged soccer mom type. But this year, after the incidents in Central Park in San Francisco and New York, it was describing racial profiling by a white woman. I know people named Karen. They don't like this.
No, for understandable reasons. So, you know, Karen, you know, I guess a canonical Karen is a middle-aged white woman who's unaware of and perhaps abuses her privilege. Where that comes from, the etymology is a little bit debated. People like talking about this one, but it looks like it came out of comedy. A few different comics used Karen in stand-up routines. Why Karen, why that name got grabbed for this? It was a popular name in the 1950s and 1960s for white baby girls. So now it's a common name for white middle-aged women. We could describe this as an instance of what we would call metonymy, where one part of something is being used to label a whole. So we're taking an example of a category and using it to label a category. So it's just a language process, and that's how language works. And is it good? Is it bad? And do we feel bad for women named Karen? Who can say? It just is. That's how language is. What we have sort of arises out of these processes.
Well, Dan Sanford, there's so much more to talk about, including language coming from young people and from corporate culture. We do need to take a break, but we want to talk about those things and more. Our phone number here at Maine Calling, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post on our Facebook page, or send us a tweet. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from InSource Renewables, supporting Waldo County Bounty's effort to provide hunger relief with the help of local growers. WaldoCountyBounty.org.
And the number to call to support your public radio station right now is 800-866-1475. You can also text GIVE to that number, or you can give online at mainepublic.org. I'm Nora Flaherty, your All Things Considered host. I am joined today by Mark Simpson, and we are asking you on this last day of our Pledge from Home Community Impact Drive to come forward and do right by your public radio station.
That's right. Call that number, 1-800-866-1475. You can also text GIVE to that number, 800-866-1475, or go to mainepublic.org. Just click on that little red button on the top right-hand part of your screen there that will get you on the path to becoming a listener contributor. Maybe you've been listening for a long time, but you've never taken that first step to give to public radio. Well, there's no time like the present on this, the last day of our Community Impact Pledge from Home Drive. Take advantage right now by calling 800-866-1475, and your gift will be enhanced by Maine Community Foundation. They'll be giving 33 meals to Good Shepherd Food Bank if you make that donation now. So become a philanthropist in a way that you maybe weren't thinking. You can double your giving power here. Do something great. 800-866-1475 or go to mainepublic.org.
Absolutely. Again, 800-866-1475, mainepublic.org. Just think for a moment about what Maine Public brings to your day every day. It's the place that you turn for the latest coronavirus information and guidelines. We are the statewide feed for the Maine CDC briefings, and we air it here on radio, television, online, and that's to keep you informed and safe. That's really vitally important. We've also provided extensive coverage of the vaccine rollout and on a national level, tons and tons of political coverage. We've had the presidential inauguration. This is just in the last few weeks. The impeachment hearings are coming up. And Maine Political Pulse also on a state level, bringing you the important headlines, insights, and analysis. It's a total must for me every week. I think it's probably true for a lot of people, and maybe it is for you. The number to support it is 800-866-1475. You can give online as well at mainepublic.org.
Love that Political Pulse newsletter. If you don't know about the newsletter, you can sign up for that. And then you get to know about the stuff before the podcast even drops. So very cool right there. 800-866-1475. You can still call while we get ready to go back to Maine Calling in support of our great team right there with Jen Rooks and Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith, who do all these great producing for our shows each and every week. Also, they have done tremendous coverage as we've been through this pandemic. Shout out to them. 800-866-1475. Go to mainepublic.org. You can give there even while the program's on. Think about becoming an evergreen friend to Maine Public. You can give at the $10 or the $15 or $20 a month level. Sign up and you have done your part. It automatically takes the payment and you're on your way. 800-866-1475 or go to mainepublic.org. Thanks so much.
What words would you use to describe Maine Public? Is it trust? Is it I depend on it? Is it funny because I listen on the weekends? No matter why, now is the time to step up and support this thing that does add value to your life pretty much every day. The number to call is 800-866-1475 or online at mainepublic.org. Again, I'll give the number. It's 800-866-1475. You can also text GIVE to that number, or you can give online at mainepublic.org. No matter how you give, thank you.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about the words and terminology that have surfaced in our language most recently. Joining me, Dan Sanford, a linguist who teaches writing at Bates College. Share your comments or questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Kathy on Facebook writes, my favorite expression that came out of the pandemic and Zoom meetings is, quote, Donald ducking it, which means to be only fully clothed from the waist up during a Zoom meeting. I actually hadn't heard that, but I love it.
That's a new one to me, too. I guess that's a, that's a great example of how when we need a new concept, we need a way to talk about it. And that is a new
Zoom pants. I do like that one. Susan on Facebook says, least favorite expressions. Not so much. I get it. Overused.
Yeah. So, you know, whenever you
Susan likes those not so much. Go on. I couldn't resist.
Whenever you get, you know, these new collocations, so words being used together in new ways, like it starts taking on a new kind of meaning and a new discourse function, you know, you can sort of think about the ways that people use those in conversation. And people always have feelings about new varieties of language. So I get it, but I think those are probably with us to stay.
We'll go to Pat in Lewiston. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Jennifer. Thank you. The phrase that is currently driving me right up the wall is, and I hear it from newscasters, I hear it from people being interviewed, and I hear it over and over again, is, I mean. Every sentence seems to be prefaced with, I mean. I assume that we know that they're saying what they mean, but they say, I mean, before everything.
Dan, what can you tell us about this?
Well, let's see. I think there are two ways we could talk about I mean. One is, so in conversation, we have these things that are called filled pauses where, you know, conversation's happening in real time and we need just a little bit of a moment to process and get what we're saying ready. So is kind of the classic one. So if I say, That's where I think we should go for dinner. Then that is acting like a filled pause. I'm just filling that space with the vocalization. So I think I mean is a useful filled pause. I mean, that's what we're planning to do this evening. But I think we could also talk about that as sort of a discourse marker. So, you know, if we're having a conversation, I mean can sort of be used to profile. Let's see, what does that do? I guess that I want to focus on my own take on something as opposed to something that I'm trying to profile as an objective reality or what someone else thinks or what an authority thinks.
Yeah, it seems to me maybe a bit of a modesty, a humility thing. I don't want to be pronouncing this. I just want to tell you what I think.
Oh, I think that's spot on. Yeah, I think it profiles a sort of authenticity. I mean, a lot of what we're doing in language is we're deciding how we're going to cast something. It's not just the information we're getting across. It's the kind of affect and emotion and how we're putting it in a frame, what we're casting attention to. And I think you're exactly right about what I mean is doing there.
And what was that first expression you used for sort of a space holder, Dan? Yeah. Oh, and I'm wondering this, the one that drives me crazy, Pat, is when people say, so, you know, ask someone a question, so, but the irony is, as much as it drives me crazy when other people do it, I find myself doing it. Tell us about that, Dan.
Right. So all of those filled pauses, you know, I've thought about
filled
those a
pauses,
lot.
Right.
So, you know, I use them. There's kind of a, in linguistics, we talk about prescriptive rules and descriptive rules. So prescriptive rules are, you know, what language or grammar people tell us we're supposed to do or not supposed to do. But in linguistics, we're focused on descriptive rules, which is just describing what language does. And filled pauses are, they're a pretty universal part of language. But they vary, and they sort of vary across register. So, I catch myself doing this. There are certain filled pauses that I use in more informal settings, like at home with my family, versus filled pauses that I would use in a more academic setting at work. So it's just, it's another way that language can vary across settings and be used in different ways, and also changes in ways that is always upsetting for people when language changes.
Pat, thanks for calling in. We'll go to Philip, who's calling from Aroostook County. Hi, Philip. Go ahead.
Hi. Very interesting program. one of the new words that bothers me is insecure. I get a lot of requests, as most people do, for donations and things for people. They are hungry and this, that, and the other. And I had to write back and tell one company I got so that I would be more than glad, because I've sent them money before. But if they were hungry, but I don't know about being insecure. I don't respond to that.
Philip, I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is something journalists face a lot, that a word, we struggle between choosing the word that everybody knows, for example, in this case, hunger, with the terminology that people who work in that area, that sphere, are actually using today. And there may be all sorts of reasons for them having switched the way they use that word. And so I'm glad you called, and you sort of hit the nail on the head with that one. There are a lot of examples of that. Dan, how do we shift from, you talked about language not being prescriptive, that it's hard to make rules, but there are a lot of groups out there trying to make rules about how we talk, what words we use.
Yeah. You know, there are many in the United States and many in other countries. I mean, these efforts, they tend not to work. I mean, when you're trying really hard to set rules for how language should work, what you usually end up doing is creating kind of a wider gap between what's acceptable in writing and more formal ways of speaking and then what people do in formal conversation, because nothing stops language change. Yeah, I mean, insecurity, that's a nice example of language doing something pretty helpful. You know, and I definitely understand, caller, your feelings about it. But we could look at this as a kind of metaphor. Like, the word security is really powerful. I mean, it brings up for us all of these feelings of safety and how we're affected by the world. So then when we put that in an expression like food security, you know, we're bringing all of those ideas into it with this sort of metaphorical process. So we're putting on the idea of food and whether you have enough to eat, whether you can find food, some of these feelings we have around safety and security. And that's, I think that's why the expression has become so common.
Philip, thanks so much for calling. I want to talk a little bit about slang coming from young people. If you teach at Bates, Dan, you are right there hearing all the latest language. And I want to throw some words out there, in part to talk about them, but in part also because I don't know about you, but I find it really fun to use young people language around my kids and mortify them, to say, asking them to spill the tea or saying that something is fire. So why don't you throw out a few for us and help the rest of us have a good laugh?
You're talking about one of the most fun parts of my job, because you get to see language change in process. Let's see, a few in the last year that I've noticed and loved. So finna is really popular among young people, and you see a lot in social media. So finna is a shortening of fixing to. So like, I'm fixing to eat. So fixing is being used in fixing to as an auxiliary that gives extra information about the verb. So I'm fixing to eat says more than I will eat. It says I intend to, I want to, I plan to, I'm about to eat. Fixing to is, it's in a few dialects of English. It's in Appalachian English, it's in African-American vernacular English, and it's in many Southern dialects. In language, there's this process where whenever you have things that are always occurring together, they start to chunk. So our brain starts processing them as one lexical unit. And when we articulate them, when we say them, they start to blend together. So in this case, fixing to becomes fixin' to becomes finna. So finna popped up in hip-hop among Black artists for whom finna was a word in their native dialect. The word was borrowed from Avi through hip-hop. And subcultures are always a rich source of slang, because when people use slang from a subculture, they're sort of aligning themselves with the cultural cachet of that subculture. Linguists call that covert prestige. And that's the story of a lot of American words. Cool, dig, many, many others came from Avi, African-American vernacular English, through hip-hop or soul or rock and roll or other forms of Black musical expression.
Mm. And I need to let everybody who doesn't know about it know about the Urban Dictionary. If a young person in your life uses a phrase you don't know, I have never found the Urban Dictionary to not have that phrase.
Yeah, that's a really helpful online resource. Also, take it with a grain of salt, because another thing young people love doing is going on to the Urban Dictionary and putting in definitions that may or may not be true.
Oh, really? That's good to know. That's funny. Oh, that's great. Go ahead. Yeah, give us another one.
Another word that we've seen a lot of in last year, Stan, in social media online discourse. Stan looks like it's from an Eminem song, Stan, about an obsessed fan. It looks like a blend or a portmanteau, so which blends two words to get sort of a combined or composite meaning. So in this case, stalker and fan. And the way that it's used today is as a verb, so you stan somebody or something. So we have another great story. This is a noun becoming a verb, and it's almost always used to refer to oneself in a sort of self-deprecating way, indicating that one's own fandom is sort of over the top or cringeworthy.
So let's talk about the term woke. I understand this is evolving. Young people were using this in a positive way to describe someone who is enlightened in a genuinely politically correct way, but then it kind of got taken over and changed. Tell us about the word woke and who might use it now and how.
So woke has a great etymology. Woke has a long story in America. So wake is a verb that has largely passed from American English, replaced by wake up, but it used to be around in common usage with the past tense woke. And that held on in African-American vernacular English, with woke also being used as a sort of participle to describe it, the condition of being awake. And then metaphor, through the same processes we've been talking about, like with see, shifted that to being aware, to knowing what's going on. And that's a really old usage. There's a Lead Belly song from the 30s where Lead Belly says to stay woke, in the sense of sort of keep your head on a swivel, know what's going on around you. This most recent sense of woke means to be awake specifically to issues of racism and social justice, seeing America for what it is. And that sense of stay woke, it's older than Black Lives Matter, but it was really taken up by Black Lives Matter and used as a sort of rallying cry. And then it came to be used more broadly by young people and by college students and others positioning themselves as allies. And now we have the emergence of people, usually on the other end of the political spectrum, using it as a sort of derogatory shorthand for people who they see as engaging in a sort of false activism or trying to position themselves in a certain way. And that's tied up, I think, with a bit of making fun of the grammar of it, because woke is a form that's not grammatically used in that way in standard American English.
All right. Well, we'll go to Ethan and Sacco. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Great show. Very interesting. And I've noticed that the term woke originally started out as, in my mind, it was kind of like, are you really aware of what's really going on with, like, regard to conspiracies and stuff? And then the right kind of took it over to mean, oh no, it's a left term thing. We can't use that. So things changing that way. And also, the ending hunger thing, that is really sort of annoying now, because I understand people are trying to do good, but it's just not accurate. You can never really end hunger. And then on the other another note on that is the term at the end of the day. If I hear that anymore, I swear. But my real point and my reason for the call was that the weaponization of language now, like I'm hearing a lot of, Marxism and throwing terms around. And in this digital age, I don't know if these things act, number one, I don't know if they really apply anymore. And number two, I think that you've had conversations about dividing in this country. I think that a lot of times these words can be used to stop the deep dive, if you will, of discussion of bigger topics that we need to discussed before we become even more divided.
Sure.
So.
Good point,
but
Ethan. Dan, I'm going to give you a minute to talk about the weaponization of language, stopping people from having conversations.
I think that's a really good observation. And I think this has been something that's been very striking about the last year. Like we were talking about with woke, snowflake, there are a lot of words that have become really weaponized in the last year in a way that seems really striking. Like their meaning is being actively negotiated from the different sides of the political spectrum. So it makes sense that as a culture, we're really wrestling with the sort of polarization of ways of thinking and what facts are and how we think about things, so that we would see that in language, that language is sort of acting as a kind of a proxy war for for how these things are playing out in our culture.
We're talking about how our language is changing, and rapidly. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Marvin Design Gallery by Eldridge Lumber in Portland, a Marvin retailer providing windows and doors, committed to helping people live well in their homes.
You are listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. I'm Nora Flaherty, joined by Mark Simpson, asking you on this last day of our Pledge From Home Community Impact Drive to come forward and do your part for your public radio station. The number to call to do that is 800-866-1475. You can also text GIVE to that number, or you can give online at mainepublic.org.
That's right, Nora. And you have the chance right now to double the impact, double your giving when you call 800-866-1475. If you do that, make a gift of support to Maine Public. Maine Community Foundation is going to be sending 33 meals to the Good Shepherd Food Bank. So a great way for you to double your philanthropic giving here at Maine Public, helping out great causes here. We know that many people are under duress during these difficult times in different ways, and you can help in multiple ways when you call 800-866-1475. Double your giving power. Think about becoming an evergreen friend to Maine Public. That means you give your credit card info or your bank info, and your membership is paid for every month with no effort on your part. It's effortless, seamless. And Nora, you know, as we are busy all the time, it's great to have one thing kind of off your plate that you don't have to worry about. Do that now. Ask about becoming an evergreen friend. 800-866-1475.
We say with the Evergreen Friend program that you set it and forget it. It probably
don't
calls back
it,
to a, yeah, well, but you can forget it, because once you have put in once you've given us your information, we will continue doing that. We will continue to get that donation every month until you tell us different. That's how it works. And it allows us to do all kinds of great things in the future. It allows us to know that it's coming. And it allows us to plan to do more big projects that will add more value to your listening life, because Maine Public Radio, like all public radio stations, is listener supported. That's how we work. It's that operational support that we get from listeners that is vital to everything that we do here. It gives us equipment so that we can tell the stories that you are hearing on the radio, and also so that we can get that radio out to you. I mean, like literally. It also helps us to do the reporting work that we do every day. That stuff is vital to your life. It helps keep you basically informed and contextualized. It helps you know what's going on in your world. And that is, especially right now in this world today, absolutely vital. The number is 800-866-1475, or you can give online at mainepublic.org.
Think about becoming a new member here if you've not done it already. Maybe you're a longtime listener, and this is your chance to be a first-time caller into our great support team. Become a member here at Maine Public by calling 1-800-866-1475. You can also text the word GIVE to that number, 800-866-1475, and you'll get the link to sign up for a membership, or go to mainepublic.org. You can click on the red donate button there. Maybe you're on our site right now. Maybe you're streaming Maine Calling. Maybe you're reading a great news story. Maybe you're wondering what's coming up on PBS later this evening. You can find it all there. Maybe you find your mouse straying over to that red donate button. You're entranced by it. You start clicking on it, and then you're on your way. 800-866-1475. That's the number to call. You can give it mainepublic.org. We're going to get ready to go back to more Maine Calling here, but you can still call and go to the site while the show is on. That number again, 800-866-1475, and thanks for your support.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about new words and terms that we're using in these changing times. My guest today, Dan Sanford, who is a linguist who teaches writing at Bates. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I can tell you already that we have far more calls and emails than we'll be able to get to. So if you want to continue this conversation afterwards, I suggest Facebook might be a fun place to do that. We'll go to Keith, who's calling from Scarborough. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Yeah, how are you today?
Oh, Keith, I can barely hear you. Are you on speakerphone?
No, I'm on my radio phone. I'm here from Scarborough.
Shoot. You know what? I'm going to ask you to call back. We'll try to get right back to you if you can call back. We can barely hear you. We're going to go to Jared calling from Rockland. Hi, Jared. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Jared McCannell. I'm the executive director of Penobscot Bay Language School here in Rockland. And I just wanted, first of all, I want to say thank you. What a wonderful conversation. I'll keep it quick because I know you've got lots of other folks that are excited to talk about language and the dynamic nature of language changing. I just wanted to comment that although this conversation is framed in the context of English and during the pandemic is a catalyst, language is dynamic and it's always changing. And one quick example, you know, down in the American Southwest, there's a large population of Spanish speakers who have incorporated aspects of English language into the common vernacular. And so you, instead of having almuerzo or almuerzo for lunch, they're having lonche. You know, that's one example I wanted to throw out. But also, around the world, there are a number of languages, in particular Romance languages, that have gendered words. So you've got different endings on words for masculine and feminine. If you remember back to your Spanish 1 class in high school. And there's a phenomenon right now going on where there are folks that want to change that. They want to deconstruct the binary system, linguistic system we have, and start to use words instead of, for example, chico is boy and chica is girl in Spanish. And when you talk about a plural number of boys and girls, you always use the masculine version, chicos. And there's a movement to change that to be chiques, which is a neutered form of that, which Latin had as well. And so I just wanted to comment that the dynamic nature of language isn't unique to English. It happens all over the world, and there are a lot of people using that to help do great things like deconstruct that binary system we live in when it comes to gender, as well as clarify and modernize the language so we don't alienate people.
Sure. Dan.
Yeah. Thank you so much for those points. And I could not agree with you more strongly, Jared, that nothing we're talking about here today is unique to English. English is not special in terms of how language processes play without it. And these are parts of global patterns. I think part of what's so fun about studying language, and I'm sure you've come across this a lot too, Jared, is just how different languages will take different paths to the same thing. In English, we make adverbs with li, which comes from Old English leech, which was body. So if you're completely, you're complete bodied. But in Romance languages, they did it coming from, their adverbs are formed from mind, like mente. So if you're completamente something, you're complete minded, you know, but we're getting at the same meanings, and different languages can take different paths to the same thing, and that happens with how we grapple with social issues too.
Jared, thanks so much for your call. We have an email from John, and my producer has written a note. This one's for you, Jen. am I crazy to think impact is a noun, period? And they know that one of my pet peeves, even though I'd like to think that I don't have pet peeves, is the word impact is a verb. But John writes, my stomach turns every time I hear impactful, like he's been very impactful in this organization. Ugh, what's wrong? What's wrong with he's had a big impact on this organization?
That fluidity of grammatical categories between nouns and verbs and adjectives, that is such a hallmark feature of language. I think it's lovely and remarkable that we can do that. We can sort of, on the fly, change the grammatical category of a word, and people will understand what we're saying when we do that. And also, that's a huge process that takes place over time. And as that happens, the meaning of things change. Like, let's see, email used to be a noun, but now that's all of us as a verb. And we've seen that just happen with Zoom in the last year. Zoom was a noun, and has very, very quickly come to be in common usage as a verb, and not just for making a Zoom call, but for this much more general thing of any kind of video chat. And that's great, because we didn't have a great word for that. So it's nice to see one coming into more common usage. And I think it's entirely likely that in 50 years, no one will remember the company Zoom, but we'll all be using Zoom as our verb for talking about video conferencing in the same way that now we talk about fridge to describe all refrigerators.
You know, and that's interesting. I'm so glad you said that, because I was sort of wondering, what do you think will stick and what do you think will go away? Or is it impossible to know?
It's definitely impossible to know. I mean, predicting language is like predicting the weather, where you can, it's easy to look at how we got to where we are, but there's this element of chance. Language is a complex adaptive system. There are just a million factors at work, so it's hard to tell where it's going. But there are general tendencies, like, you know, the topic of borrowing between languages came up in the context of Spanish in the Southwest. Jared called that one in. And that's such a powerful process in language change. You don't know what exact words are going to get borrowed, but what you do know is that in any language context situation, like between English and Spanish in the Southwest, there's going to be borrowing between languages, and there's going to be more borrowing in the direction of whatever the dominant language in the society is.
Yeah, and famously, the French have pushed back against it. But we're going to try to squeeze in one more call. Go to Tricia in Waldo. Hi, Tricia. If you could be quick, that'd be great.
Yes, thank you so much. Great show. The first idea is about that words exist, but who uses those words can have great changes in meaning. I think specifically about the N-word and who's using it. The second idea is for years, I have called people out when they're using a phrase that is violent, such as, oh, there's so much traffic, I was ready to put a gun to my head. That kind of thing. They're using violence as an expression of a nonviolent emotion. I'm frustrated, or, you know, whatever. And then the third is it seems very common, and this is kind of a pet peeve, when people insert the word right. So the population of the state has increased, right? And so now there's more traffic, right?
Okay, I want to give Dan a chance to respond. Dan, we are quick on time, but this idea of adding right to the end of a sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a really fun thing to study across dialects, the way that different dialects of American English sort of put on a marker at the end to make it a question. Let's see, in Wisconsin, where I'm from, there's a lot of cold out in the American Southwest. There's a lot of cold out, Kano, and cold out, right? Yeah, it's another sort of regional variation on the same thing. It's handy, you know, because you can turn a statement really quickly into a yes or no question, where you're inviting agreement.
And sometimes it's a statement of the obvious when, you know, it's 10 below and you say cold out, right? So anyway, Tricia, thank you so much for bringing that up. Unfortunately, we're having so much fun and it's so interesting, but we are out of time. Dan, thank you so much for joining us for the hour. Daniel Sanford, a linguist at Bates College, the director of writing at Bates and the Academic Resources Commons. He's the author of The Roman and Littlefield Guide for Peer Tutors. Today's sound engineer was George Thomas, and we had help from John Keimel. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandrow. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.